30 years, Guido Rahr has been at the epicenter of salmon and steelhead conservation. I consider us really good friends, and our lives have intersected many times. In this episode of Fin and Fire with Jeff Mishler, I sit down with Guido, the president and CEO of the Wild Salmon Center, and we just tell some stories about how all of this came to be. I ask Guido some tough questions about salmon and steelhead conservation, and I hope you're as surprised by the answers as I was. Fin and Fire with Jeff Mishler is brought to you by Fin and Fire, the fly shop in Redmond, Oregon. Fin and Fire is the West's leading retailer of your favorite outdoor brands. If you prefer to shop online, go to finandfire.com and check out their inventory. Well, thanks for hosting me at the world headquarters of the Wild Salmon Center. It's kind of an honor, and it's really a nice production space because you have this awesome little white noise encompassing pod thing that is a perfect sound studio for us. So thanks for inviting me. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah. I'm good.
What does a day look like for you at the Wild Salmon Center in Portland, Oregon?
Oh, you know, I was in Mongolia last week, and then I needed a couple days, to get back into the right kind of rhythm. And I did over the weekend, and I feel so much better. So I'm kind of hit the reset button. End of last week, I was kind of a disheveled mess after being on the airplane so long, and now I'm feeling freaking awesome.
That's great.
This week, yeah.
Travel, that trip back and forth from the Far East is, going isn't as bad, but coming back is a killer. I don't know why. I think it's maybe the anticipation or the expectation of, you know, what's there. But when you, oh my God, even just coming back from Alaska kills me.
I know. If I don't exercise or move my body the day or two before, I just twitch the whole time in the air. My body is not meant to sit still. Unless I'm asleep,
right,
or unconscious.
Yeah, if anyone has seen you fly fish a river, they know that you don't sit still. It's impossible. The day you got your jet boat, it was like, oh God, Guido got a jet boat.
Oh my God, it's like ADD fishing, you know? It's like, just let loose the Gorgon. I'm just like, oh no, I'm going to go over there. Stop, take two casts. No fish. I'm going over here, back and forth, ending up, of course, right back to where I started, and then finally just take a deep breath and just fish.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Well, I will say though, you were the most effective this spring at finding those critters. So, I don't think anybody put as much time, into the process of springer fishing, but definitely the results were there because you did catch more fish than anyone I saw.
Well, I definitely averaged a fish a day. You know, and a fish a day is great. Those are amazing fish. And I put my time in.
Yes, you did.
And I love it because I'm not being, guided, and I'm alone in my little boat, and I don't have to talk to anybody, and I can try to open my senses, try to figure out what's going on, and it's super challenging. And it's hunting. It's not fishing. It really is hunting. This is true for taimen and salmon and steelhead, and It's a different kind of thing, a little bit.
I don't ever get tired of it. Living down there has helped me focus my effort, if that makes any sense. That I look at certain times of the tide, and I think those are the best times to go. But then you come back after, it's like, oh yeah, I got two on the incoming tide. And I'm like, great, I guess I should have stuck it out a little longer. But yeah, you really did well this year. I was really impressed. You'd send me pictures of these amazing salmon, and it's like, should have stuck it out a little bit longer. But yeah, you worked hard this year.
I worked really hard, and by the end of the, my long-suffering wife Lee is like, she wants me to have those days. She knows I wait all year for those days, and then the questions come: how much longer is salmon season go on for, and when is it over? And of course, I'm like, well, June, it keeps going all the way through July, and then I'm like saying to myself, just stop, and it's like, it's almost over, honey, and don't worry, just another day or two, and I push it right to the edge every season, and I'm just so grateful that Lee, she knows how important it is for me, but it's not easy, I know.
I can speak to that. It is a struggle. I think, my point of reference is that I don't know any happily married fishing guides, right? And I don't know anyone who's as obsessed about fly fishing as you or I are, who are in, maybe one person. I might know one person who's in a happy marriage, but it's their business as opposed to just being obsessed with the process of fishing. It definitely wears out relationships.
Yeah, I mean, I don't profess to having found the perfect balance, and I'm lucky because Lee is really committed to our marriage and relationship, and she's an amazing mom, and she also likes to go out there with me. But there's just windows of time where I'm like, these are my days, and I'm going to fish alone or with one of my boys. But actually, sometimes I'm like, you guys can fish with me, but you've got to bring your own pram or something or boat, because I really like being alone in my boat.
Yeah, I know.
And I mean, fishing with me when I'm alone and on the hunt is like, the minute you get your line out, I'm going to be moved to another spot, you know? So it's just like fishing like whiplash, you know? Like, I thought we were going to, no, I want to go here. I want to move a little bit here, a little bit to the right, a little bit to the left. But if I'm, you know, having those days in the spring and in the fall, that's really important. And I'm just grateful that I get those days.
Yeah. She's great. I've known her since you guys met.
That's right. Right when we met.
I do. Yeah. So I think the listeners don't really understand that Guido Rar and I have a shared history that goes back 30 years, probably. I think it was 1991. 90 or 91 is when we met.
Mm-hmm.
You had just, you were, so this isn't something I never really dug into, but you were the host of a fly fishing show called, what was it called?
On the Fly.
On the Fly. That's right. And you were working on that show and trying to establish your career in conservation. What were those early days like trying to get a foothold in the world of, you know, conservation?
So when I was in college, I had a TV show called On the Fly, and it was an hour once a week. I tied flies and talked about how to fish the flies, and it was really primitive, TV, public access. I didn't get paid for it. One camera, one take, 28 minutes, and I loved it, and I really learned how to speak, to do public speaking and tell stories and lose my fear, you know, not that it ever really goes away. And people love that show. And then I kept doing it, and I said, I really want to do this for my career. Excuse me. And I tried and tried to make it work, and we had the idea for River Monsters, and I wrote a treatment. And this was 15 years or 20 years before River Monsters. But we had the idea of the hunt and the exploration and the science behind the great fish species and the mystery of how to get to them and make an adventure out of it. I never could make that work. And then I went to work for the local news, Channel 12 News in Portland. And that lasted a little bit. I was the outdoor reporter. Oh, my God. Me and all my long blonde hair and all this. And actually, I was starting to cut my hair by that point. So that was
the hippie kid from Yale.
Oh, no. No, that was, believe me, I cut my hair before I showed up there. And then I did some stuff for ESPN, but it just didn't work. And then I was living in Portland and trying to get these things started, and I had graduated from University of Oregon, and I just couldn't make it work. And then my cousin Spencer Beebe said, I need somebody down in southern Mexico. And Spencer ran the Nature Conservancy International Program, and he knew I was a reptile collector. So I grew up as a reptile collector before I was even a fisherman. And southern Mexico is ground zero for reptile diversity. And Spencer said, I need somebody, and I'll give you the shot. And I said, I'm ready. I'm going to go. And I just flew to Chiapas, Mexico, and that marked a turning point in my career.
Yeah, I think we met just after you'd returned.
I came back. So after Chiapas, yeah. I worked my way up to the Nature Conservancy and the Conservation International, and ended up in Washington, D.C. And then decided to go back to Oregon. Drove the van again to Portland. Started applying to grad schools, hanging out in Portland, and met you.
That's when it was.
Yeah.
That's when it was.
That's right.
And, you know, I could say that we shared the Russia experience, but I can say also that the reason I went to Kamchatka on that first expedition was because of you. Had you not called me and left a message on my, you know, we had those voice tape machines, and I checked it from the airplane. I was flying back from New York. I just directed a commercial, and I was landing in Portland. I checked my machine, and you left this message. I met this guy, Pete Sovrol, and you need to give him a call because he's putting together this expedition to go to Kamchatka. And I told him, you're the guy. I didn't know who Pete was. I had no clue. And so I called him, and my impression of Pete was very different than the reality of Pete when I met him. He's a stoic, kind of slow talker person, and I had the vision of what Pete looked like. And then when I met him, he's like 54, 55 year old guy, full of life,
you know,
the admiral leading us forward into this. So, but I'm forever grateful for that experience, because without that connection, I think my life in particular would have taken a completely different turn. I don't know where I would have found traction in the world of conservation, but because of that, I was able to apply photographic skills, writing skills, and other things that have helped other people communicate, you know, the needs of this. So I appreciate that, and I'm forever thankful for that connection. And, you know, we remain good friends today, so that's all.
No, it took a, you know, Jeff, thinking back, so I first went over to the Russian Far East in, like, I think it was 91 or 92.
You'd been to the Bolshoi.
To the Bolshaya.
Bolshaya, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And in Kamchatka. And then I came back and Pete called and said, and I'd written this article, published it in Fly Fisherman. Frank Amato published it.
That's right.
About the Russian Far East.
That's right.
And then Pete called and said he was organizing an expedition to go to Kamchatka to look for steelhead. And I just couldn't do it. And I regret not going. But I knew someone crazy enough to go, which was you. And it took some huevos. To get on that, to fly into that zone. Just remember, this was our Cold War enemy.
Oh, yeah.
And this was the early days. And I look back at that now, and that was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, Jeff. I mean, you caught the first steelhead ever hooked in the Russian Far East.
Yeah.
By a Westerner.
By a Westerner.
By a Westerner.
Right.
And that trip I took before that on the Bolshaya, I became, when I caught a Masu salmon, the first Westerner to catch all Pacific salmon species on
awesome.
On any kind of gear.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember you saying, well, I should go to the Explorers Club in New York and apply or whatever, because I could qualify because I, you know, had a first in that regard.
That's right.
And I didn't know anything about that. Were you already a member of the Explorers Club?
I was, and I don't know how rigorous their acceptance requirements are these days, but it helps to have had some original expedition experience.
True. And I can imagine the networking potential is... Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I was young. I was just lucky to be standing where I was. So I didn't put a lot of thought into it after you'd mentioned it. So it wasn't too long ago. I was looking at the New York Times and there was a picture of Guido Rahr, and I think the title of the story was something like, "This man might be the world's best fly fisherman," or something to the effect. It's something crazy like that. And I thought, man, what a burden.
Well, it's completely not true. I mean, you could tell for that writer who doesn't know anything about fly fishing or that audience, but I cringed, because I know a lot of fishermen that are a lot better than I am, right? Starting with you. But anyway, it was flattering and then horrifying and alternately.
I can't imagine it. I just was like, oh,
I got
God.
Lots of shit for that. God.
No doubt.
Oh, Guido, you're the world's greatest fly fisherman. And I'm just like, all right, thanks.
Oh my God. Oh Jesus. So let's go back to fly fishing. You know, that's something you've always done. I've never seen you as a gear angler or a kind of, like, you know, a person who explores with different methods. You've always just kind of been all in on the fly fishing. And so, you know, at what point did you just realize that, or maybe it wasn't a realization, how did this all come to be? Like, it kind of defines who you are.
So I grew up as a reptile collector, so I knew about lower vertebrates, and I was really comfortable with that assembled group of species. And then I became a really devoted spin fisherman when we lived in Minnesota.
Oh.
When I was 11 years old, we moved to Minnesota, which was a hard move from Portland, Oregon to Minneapolis, to Wayzata, actually Mound, Minnesota. We lived on Lake Minnetonka. And it was hard on me. I was into, you know, rubber boas and Pacific giant salamanders and, you know, Pacific chorus frogs and the hope for a mountain king snake or something. And now I'm in the land of painted turtles and garter snakes, you know, and leopard frogs, but not interesting. So I kind of holed up in my room and started building my reptile collection. But the only other thing to do really was go down to the dock and fish. And so I'd fish for bass and crappies. And so I was pretty good with an ultralight spinning rod. So we would go out each year to the Deschutes, where we have some family cabins near Maupin, upstream from Maupin. And my grandfather and my aunts and my uncles were all fly fishers. Now, they ignored me as a strange little kid, and I kind of ignored them. But I went down to the river with my ultralight spinning rod and jointed Rapala and just freaking worked my way through all the big fish that they've been trying all summer long to catch. And, of course, back then, I'd take them back, you know, to the house by the gills, walking past my grandfather with an 18-inch rainbow. And they immediately, my aunts and uncles and my grandfather said, this is a freaking major crisis. DEFCON 9, we need to have a meeting. Young Chipper, which was my nickname growing up, was Chipper, is doing devastating damage to, and they'd name these different trout. Like if they broke your line once, they get a star. So as a one-star general, second would be a two-star general, a three-star. I was getting the four-star generals, and they had it, and they would not deign to teach me how to fly fish, but they realized they had to teach me how to fly fish before I completely annihilated the trout population. So I did learn how to fly fish. And they let me alone, and they still would never tell me the best locations. But I grew up in this culture of the people at the dinner table telling stories of great rainbows and steelhead, and he refused this, and he took that, and I was left in a crumbling mess on the bank after my line broke. And it really made an impression, and I found that my natural instincts and passions were perfectly aligned for fly fishing.
I was the oddball as well growing up. My grandmother used to tell stories about my grandfather fishing for cutthroat. And I've mentioned this on a podcast before, but it was her stories that totally captivated me. And all I really wanted to do was live on the Oregon coast and fish for sea run cutthroats and salmon and steelhead. Mm-hmm. And it was from a very early age. And my parents, I mean, it was totally new territory for them. My dad didn't fly fish, and I'm sure that I pestered and begged him to take me until he finally did. But it was the same thing, kind of a progression from gear fishing, and then I discovered fly fishing, and then it was me, you know, like really prodding and saying, Dad, let's take the fly rods and go fishing. So I was really fortunate because my parents were open to that. I can only imagine what it's like for a kid to have that passion or that desire and then not have the opportunity. I mean, where's the outlet? I mean, what do you resort to if you have the if you just are curious about it, but you never get to experience it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the scarcity does increase the excitement when you do get time on the water. But listen, I mean, there are kids all over this country that are suffering because they don't, are not allowed or not given the chance to have a connection with nature. And it's making our society not well. I mean, we as a species, and especially Americans, North Americans, are suffering because we don't get out in nature and we don't move our bodies around. And you look at this, they even call it nature deficit disorder. So humans have evolved for millions of years to have a deep connection with nature. The structure of the neurons in our brains and all the biological ways we've evolved, you can't just in a generation or two deprive an organism of its natural habitat and expect there not to be problems. And you look at obesity and all the problems that are facing, you know, children and young men and women today. I mean, nature's not going to solve all those things, but we've been so blessed, Jeff, to be able to be alone in nature and our body and feeling the sun on our skin. And, you know, I'm glad you raised that because, I mean, I wish I could do more, or there needs to be more done to get kids on the river. You know, it's just one portal into nature. There's different portals, but it's a good thing for all of us. And so I applaud, you know, movements in that direction. And
it doesn't have to be fly fishing. It doesn't have to be. It's just standing on the riverbank, turning over some rocks.
Yeah.
And then you look under the rock and you see this entire world under there. It's like, oh my God, there are these insects.
Yeah.
And then the insects get smaller and smaller. And then you realize, oh wait, this is all connected. Mm-hmm. But kids that never see that, they don't understand that ecosystem concept.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of we're part of a functioning ecosystem, at least still.
Oh yeah. And, excuse me, various degrees of function. But having that chance, I think there's a lot to be said for home waters, like having your lake or your pond or your stream that you can imprint on and start to kind of unpack, excuse me, you know, and get to know. Mm-hmm.
I had a creek in the backyard when I was probably from 6 years old until 12 years old. And the creek was, you know, 200 yards behind the house, but I lived down there. Mm-hmm. You know, we found our first yellow jacket nest and got stung beyond like 13 bee stings at one time. But, you know, salamanders and the lessons learned there when you're 8, 9, 10 years old are pretty simple in that if you want to cross the creek and jump across the creek and you fall in the creek, well, next time you better find a better way to cross the creek, right? Mm-hmm. So you build a bridge or you make smart choices. You begin this journey of resourcefulness where you're making discoveries that actually are problem solving, mm-hmm. as opposed to just being a passive participant. You're actually, like Lantani would say about active participation, mm-hmm. the hunters and anglers or kayakers, whatever, you're actively participating in nature as opposed to just watching nature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, completely right. Different concepts.
Well, I think it's engaging those ancient neural networks too. I mean, when you're hunting or gathering, you know, your whole visual system and search imaging different things in the complicated and inscrutable kind of mass of nature, the forest, the grasslands, the river, and your mind starts looking for things and it kicks off these cycles, these behaviors that are so fundamental to our existence, and they're rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's
would you say your passion for reptiles was the gateway or the window for you?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up looking for reptiles and amphibians. I mean, by the when I was never at the soccer games and at the football games, and my parents did not participate in organized sports, and I was the oldest of five kids, and we lived way out in the country, you know, outside of Lake Oswego. But I was completely, just all I thought about and did was look for small animals. And then, you know, by the time I was 11 or 12, I'd memorized. What happened to me, Jeff, was I was dyslexic and ADD growing up. And my mother gave me, at the age of 11, a copy of Raymond Dittmar's Reptiles of North America, which was this big, thick book on reptiles of North America. I read the entire book 3 or 4 times. I memorized the Latin names of all the North American reptile species and most of the amphibian species, and I still know them today, down to the species level. And that basically pulled me out of my learning disabilities. I mean, believe me, I still suffer from some learning disabilities, as anyone around me will know. But that was transformative. And then that gave me the confidence to know a lot about something. So when I grew up and I was a strange little kid, as I mentioned, I had long hair and kind of tinted glasses, and I wore little African trade beads, and I was like this little hippie. And I really didn't care what anyone thought about me.
Which is amazing.
Because I had something that I knew more about than anybody, and I never felt insecure.
You know, that's one thing. We have kids, and what I tell my kids is pretty simple. It's like when you're young, find something or some things that you love, that you mm-hmm. that you really truly are passionate about, and become the absolute best that you can be, either as an expert of that subject matter or that activity. Just be the best that you can, because the more things you know about and the more things you become proficient at, the more doors will open for you in the future. But if you have nothing, if you really just don't have those pursuits or those passions, it's going to be really hard to open those doors, because I think it's going to get harder and harder for kids as we progress through this kind of challenging time to really break out and be different. And I think that's really important. I mean, you were definitely different. You carved out a space in this world for you, mm-hmm. as we all have tried to just make a little room for us so we can succeed. And I hope that my kids are able to do that. I know that yours are. I'm just blown away by whether they're, you know, going to an elite college or playing in a rock band. It's just like, oh my God, those kids are freaking killing it.
Well, you're nice to say that, Jeff, and we're proud of the boys, you know. But I think that one thing, it's interesting, you know, I am deeply, I don't know if suspicious is the right word, but I notice the power of gaming. And there's arguments on either side for your kids' addiction to, you know, your phone and Instagram and TikTok and video games and all of that. And I, you know, there are some benefits of learning that territory, but when you do things that are creative, or will you really learn? And let's just say it's reading a book, doing a painting, drawing a drawing, playing the guitar, writing a poem, writing in your journal. Those are things that you do kind of when you're bored, you know, when you're alone and you have some downtime and you do that. Well, I find myself, if I've got my little phone and I can do Instagram, it's like an endorphin pump,
right?
You know, it's like, it's not quite like doing a line of coke, but it's like, there's the algorithms on these things are designed to have your, I don't know if it's dopamine or whatever the neurotransmitters are that make you feel good for a microsecond. And so one of our children was doing that a lot. I don't know if it was Minecraft or something, or Call of Duty. And I noticed, and I said to Lee, I said, you know, when he's doing that, he's not doing other things. You know, like my oldest is a real Renaissance man. I mean, he's a good musician and he's an artist and he's a good fly tyer and a good angler. And he just curls up by himself and does that stuff. But when, anyway, I said, I think we need to get this stuff out of the house. And that's hard to do when kids, and so we created some rules and just said, we're going to give you an hour and a half each day. But if you break that rule once, that stuff is leaving the house and it's never coming back. And so one of the kids broke the rule and I'm like, great, now's a chance to get rid of this stuff. And we took it out of the house. And what I saw was, out comes the guitar, you know, out comes the writing tablet, out comes the book. And it's the same thing we go when we go to our fishing cabin, you know, there has been no internet. And the boys are doing things like that. And look, it's not a perfect household where there's no video, you know, and there's no cell phone, all this stuff. But I feel deeply, and even myself, that, look, what's important is that, I mean, it's not that complicated. You read, you write, and if you can create art and tie flies, do things, that is so important. And I also told the boys, I said, if you don't write it down, and if you don't write it down, it, you know, you need to write your in your journal, because your life's going to go by really quickly. And if you don't write it down after you die, nobody may even knew you existed.
Right.
And that's a hard message. And that's kind of jarring, isn't it?
Totally.
But it's something, a conversation I have with myself all the time. I need to publish more.
You're an excellent writer. And I think what you have to say, the world needs to hear. Just not only because of your writing skills, but because of your life experience.
You really have to be deliberate about it, you know. And I'm a decent journaler. But I'm looking forward to the day where I can really relax with my journals and write the stuff that I want to write. And every New Year's resolution for me is the same. Write more, publish more.
Interesting.
And have that time. You know, that every morning writing time. But it's a hard, you know, I'm struggling, you know, to do that, frankly, because I have an organization that is demanding right now. But I'm not going to, you know, at some point I'd love to, my fantasy is to, you know, to be able to do that and focus on that more.
Yeah. I'm fortunate, and that goes back to, I don't know where I would be if I hadn't gone to Russia, but I'm kind of the, I'm in the opposite space. I write all the time. And what you end up with is a laptop full of short stories and essays, and then a lot of thoughts that aren't complete. So for me, mostly it's an editing job. It isn't so much creating the work, it's actually getting it in a form that can be submitted to an editor or a publisher so that then they begin to see these threads of connection and they realize that it's an entire body of work. It's an entire lifetime of work. And so the writing part is second nature. It's just being productive and constructive with the writing, thinking about it as not just my words, but a product in a, you know, in a way that people would want to read it. So the legacy part of that is, yeah, your thoughts are great, and but then if you really want to make the mark, it like, you know, it needs to be a body of work that piques someone's interest and holds their attention.
Well, the writing process is where the thoughts and the feelings that you had, you've got to put on paper, and that organizes it, and that helps you put your arguments together and your pieces together and the clarity, even if it's a memo to yourself. There's something about writing it down.
Totally. Yeah, well, I mean, I have had this little leather book since about 1992, and I every year I put a new journal in there, mm-hmm. and I have kept those. And so I go back and I read those, and I read like how much of a freaking emotional mess I was in 1992 to 1995, mm-hmm. you know, making television commercials, going through girlfriends, like, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But to have that historical record gives me a perspective of like how far I feel like I've grown emotionally, mm-hmm. but also intellectually in the mm-hmm. way I see the world. So it mm-hmm. is critically important. I just don't know if I use these journals for fuel for my, you know, fiction that I write today. It's definitely nice to think about it, but if I went back, I don't know that I feel really comfortable diving into that person per se. It's mm-hmm. nice to be able to manufacture mm-hmm. stuff from those bits and pieces. But mm-hmm. you're right, writing. Both my kids write all the time.
That's great.
And my daughter, she's a brilliant writer. And my son has always been a writer. He's probably 300 pages into his first novel. And if he started that when he was about 9 years old, wow. I think. And he has rewritten it 3 or 4 times. And I'm just like, dude, just stop. At some point, you got to stop and go on to the next piece. Because if you keep, mm-hmm. you're never going to finish it. So finishing the work is a challenge for them. But they're both brilliant writers. And I feel really fortunate because of that. So ramble. So the Wild Salmon Center, let's kind of go a little bit to work. You ended up at the Wild Salmon Center, I think it was about 95, 96. Is that when that all started for you?
No, it was fall of 97, I think.
Was it 97?
Yeah. So what happened was I was at a little group called Oregon Trout, and Oregon Trout was kind of the eye of the storm in the early days of salmon conservation. We were the ones that petitioned to list them as endangered species. And it was an exciting time to be on. When I was on the East Coast before that, working on tropical forest conservation, I could see the salmon issue was about to blow up. So then I went to work for Oregon Trout to help them grow so they could, you know, take advantage of this chance to call awareness to the plight of salmon. And then while I was at Oregon Trout, I had an epiphany about the importance of saving the last best as another approach, not targeting the most endangered, but instead of finding the ones that aren't yet endangered, knowing they will someday be endangered, and then developing a strategy to keep them healthy, which is less expensive sometimes than trying to restore one that's been damaged. So this became the stronghold strategy, and I published some papers on it in the mid-90s, and then you introduced me to Pete Sovril, and Pete and I went out, and Pete said, I need some help. I've got this, the Wild Salmon Center was a kind of a group of volunteers organizing annual expeditions to Kamchatka, of which you were on the first one. And Pete's like, I just can't do this by myself. And I was said, I think, you know, and I, it was a chance for me to be an executive director. And I really liked Pete, and he was working in Kamchatka, and I'd been over to Russia, so I knew about the geography, but I also saw what the tropical forest conservation community had did. But they basically targeted the 25% of the world's highest biodiversity areas, you know, areas like the upper Amazon basin or the thorn forests of Madagascar, you know, Papua New Guinea, and said, we're going to target this 25% of the world's most rich, species-rich areas to protect. And I said to Pete, well, we can apply the stronghold strategy and target the best salmon rivers across the Pacific Rim and take a long view and protect them. And I gave him the scientific, or the papers that we wrote, and I developed a strategy and brought it to him. And Pete's reaction wasn't, you know, oh, that's never going to work, or it wasn't, oh, God, that's way too big. Pete was like, let's go, you know, let's do this. Mm-hmm. And he was a seasoned and visionary leader, and coming with a strategy, and Pete, who, you know, worked in the Navy his whole life, I mean, he knew how to run a ship, and he mm-hmm. knew how to be a boss, and together we built the Wild Salmon Center.
But I think you brought to them the vision of how to, like, make all this happen.
Yeah, it was perfect, you know, and Pete had the relationships in Russia with Moscow State University. And he had the courage, you know, just to go over there and let's get going.
Right.
And there was a window of time, you know, 20 years, especially that first in the late 90s and in the aughts, where we could do a lot in Russia, mm-hmm. creating new organizations and partnerships and doing groundbreaking research. And we got a ton of work done in the Russian Far East.
I think one of the challenging, I don't know, one of the questions people ask me is, you know, why aren't conservation organizations focusing on the areas that really need the help? But because I understand the importance of abundance to to an ecosystem. You know what? It's hard to explain that. Look, if you don't have abundance, you don't really understand what the ecosystem needs or what it is that is driving this ecosystem. Mm-hmm. If there are no salmon or steelhead in a river system that used to have, there's nothing to study mm-hmm. in that regard. So, like, in your words, from the Wild Salmon Center's perspective, what is it that keeps the Wild Salmon Center focused on places where there is abundance and using those as, what do you say, examples of, like, how to move forward with the organization? Because you are focusing on strongholds and you are focusing on areas where there is relative abundance. But the opposite of that is focusing on places where there aren't any fish and working to recover those. What is the benefit in looking at strongholds and focusing your effort there?
So, you know, if with a river system that has its fish and the habitat mostly intact, the cost of protecting it is lower than a system that has dams up and down it, and you have to fix all those problems. Now, the restoration and dam decommissioning is really important, but if we can kind of get ahead of the curve on the strongholds, then we're investing in defending them, which is easier to do, and, you know, we can do that. So we've decided, okay, the strongholds, which are the most important watersheds from an abundance and diversity standpoint within each ecological region of the North Pacific, our strategy is to say we're never going to let anybody mess one of these watersheds up. Mm-hmm. We'll do whatever it takes. Civil disobedience, litigation, grassroots organizing, public policy, anything. And we have never lost a fight. We've been able to protect almost all of the strongholds from significant degradation. And the strategies worked. And we defeated gold mines and hydroelectric dams and clear-cut logging and fish farms and fish hatcheries and road building. And I think we can keep doing it. We're not going to win every battle or every watershed, but if we can hang on to the big ones, I think it's be a substantial contribution. I mean, look at the Atlantic salmon situation. It's quite bad. And, you know, it's interesting. In the Pacific Northwest, people propose setting aside whole watersheds for salmon. Livingston Stone proposed it in the late 1800s, but we never did it. Mm-hmm. But it's not too late for us. And so our strategy now is to look at 2032, which is 10 years out, and try to put together the architecture of long-term conservation in every one of those watersheds across the North Pacific. And if we do that, I think we can hang on to the rivers that we're working on. And I mean habitat protection agreements, wild fish conservation agreements, and supporting local groups that can defend those systems, kind mm-hmm. of like an immune response. If we can do this, mm-hmm. and we will, it'll be the most ambitious place-based conservation strategy for any species attempted across the Pacific Rim. Now, the latest twist and turn in the road is we work in Russia in cooperation with the Russian government. Mm-hmm. But the war in Ukraine and the obviously the conflict between the United States and Russia has made every non-governmental group in Russia in the crosshairs. So Russia has kicked out the World Wildlife Fund, Greenpeace, and many, many groups, and we were finally designated as an undesirable organization 2 weeks ago, which brutal. Means that it is illegal for Russians to work with us right now.
That's brutal.
It's brutal. And after 25 years of working over there, never breaking a single law in the Russian Federation, we got swept up in this. I think we're going to be back in Russia, but not for the next few years.
Right, yeah. You and I are really lucky because we were able to sit in Arctic Army tents with Russian staff and actually make friends. I mean, our lens, you and I, the lens that we have and how we view Russia is very different than, I think, the general population's lens of Russia. Mm-hmm. And for me, what really softened everything was when, in that first year, we were talking about the Russian threat during the Cold War and how America was legitimately concerned about a war with Russia. And one of the Russian staff that was sitting around the table who spoke some English, he laughed. He's like, "You were afraid of us? We can't even talk to each other." the dialect between Kamchatka and Moscow is so heavy that we have to have a translator. Mm-hmm. Our officers have to have a translator to actually communicate with the ground troops. We can't even talk to each other. Do you think we could, like, assemble a ground war against the United States? Anyways, they giggled about it. And so for me, that was kind of like, oh, maybe, you know, our system has failed in communicating what the real threat was in that regard.
Well, we blew it, in my view. We had a chance to have a real rapprochement with Russia. And now we're in a terrible situation, you know, and it's not with a nuclear standoff with the other nuclear power in the world, and we're right back to a hair trigger standoff with another. That is not a place that anybody wanted to be. Mm-mm. And, you know, Jeff, it was a real gift, you know, for 25 years to develop deep trust and relationship with the brilliant Russian scientists and people from the Russian Far East. And we always thought that we were always, it was always going to be there. Yeah. And neither one of us may ever set foot in Russia again. And it's one of the great tragedies of my life is to see what's happened. I mean, we spent hundreds of hours in Russian Mi-8 helicopters exploring the rivers of the Russian Far East. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad we had those years. Mm-hmm. And I do hope that the tides will shift again. Mm-hmm. But we'll have to see.
So back to advocacy and the work that you're doing. When you mentioned the different, how do I say, tools in your tool chest, whether it's grassroots, a swell of grassroots support, or litigation, or whatever the tools are in that chest, which one historically has been the most effective at steering the needle?
That's a great question, Jeff. I mean, if you want to save a place, you need to get there. Well, the people that live in that place, the local communities, the First Nations, love and value its intrinsic biological beauty and health. Bristol Bay, you know, the north coast of Oregon, Kamchatka, the salmon and the healthy rivers are integrated into the economy and culture. So what you're asking those people to do is to say, let's just keep it the way it is. So if the community wants those fish and that miracle and those rivers, that has to be put. You can't do it from the outside. So that social license is fundamental. Then the question is, how do you build on that to defeat, you know, heavily financed, you know, multinationals? So, I mean, the classic example is the Skeena, right? So the Skeena is one of the last great salmon and steelhead rivers. It's the greatest steelhead river in the world. It's one of the greatest, you know, Chinook salmon, maybe the greatest remaining Chinook salmon river, frankly. It's the size of Switzerland. The Skeena is in British Columbia. It's not dammed. And the Malaysian National Energy Company wanted to build a huge LNG plant, liquefied natural gas, right at the mouth of the river on top of these eelgrass beds where all the baby fish reared when they went to the ocean, right at the mouth of the Skeena. And Skeena Wild, with support from the Wild Salmon Center, said, no, not, this is the wrong location. They said, we're not against LNG or anything, but not here. And they teamed up with the First Nations of the Skeena, and they waged a campaign against Petronas after they'd spent $1 billion on this project, and they kicked that project out of the Skeena.
That's good to know.
They won. And so it just shows you that committed and passionate local groups, especially with a diversity of interest groups, you know, First Nations really are important, can prevail.
Is there the threat of litigation? In other words, if everything falls apart and the grassroots, the swell of groundswell of grassroots support fails, if the threat of litigation is supporting that groundswell, does that matter? Because some people are really opposed to the concept of litigating your way to a win, because there are other ways. There are, as you said, like just getting enough people to like bang the gong can make change. But do the ones where you actually have the threat of litigation, is that a deterrent? Because people dig their heels in, it's like, okay, fine, go ahead and sue us, or does it work?
No, it works.
Okay.
Litigation is really important. And it often is not, you know, it has a lot of facets. It can slow projects down. It can give you time to try to build grassroots support, and both sides use it, and it just is part of the landscape. And so never underestimate the power of litigation. You know, some groups, it's relatively expensive to do litigation. They can just whip it out all the time, and it's something easy to do. And so I'm not saying it's all virtuous, but it's been pretty fundamental, you know, in places where there's the rule of law. And in fact, in Russia, litigation has been important. In Alaska, it's been very important. And so, yeah, it's pretty important.
Yeah, that's good. Well, I think a lot of people just, hey, man, you broke the law. Let's hold your feet to the fire kind of thing. It's like they don't understand why it didn't happen sooner. But I also understand that you have to have a community behind the cause or else you seem like an outlier. You know, you're the outlier coming in trying to steer change. If you don't have the local community, as you said, behind your effort, it doesn't compute. So I have two things I want to touch on there, which are probably difficult questions to answer. But one is the hatchery fish issue, right? So, you know, sport fishing in Oregon is, I don't know, it's like a $4 billion industry when you tie it in with all the purchases. It's a huge industry in Oregon. Mm-hmm. But if you lose access to harvestable fish and all of the effort is put into recovering wild stocks, which, you know, the subtext there is that I think we believe there were more wild fish than there really were. I mean, the carrying capacity for steelhead in rivers probably isn't at X like it is for salmon. Mm-hmm. You know, there weren't as many steelhead as we think there might be. But beside the point, if we don't provide angling opportunity through, you know, an abundant hatchery population, the interest in fishing will go away. How do you balance those needs of the fishing public with also an ecosystem's need to maintain diversity and healthy, if you want to call it canaries in the mineshaft, the salmonids that live in the river?
Right. That's a tough one. Okay, so what we know is that if we're going to have salmon and steelhead and trout in 100 years, and the climate, and there'll be changes to the climate and the habitat, we need wild runs with a lot of genetic diversity within those runs. And those wild runs are, it's almost like the river is like the lock, and the wild runs are like the teeth on a key. And when there's lots of diversity, it can unlock the power of the watersheds. And the problem with hatcheries is if you overwhelm those runs with hatchery fish, you erode the genetic diversity of the runs, and it weakens them over time. And there's also ecological impacts. On the other side of the coin, people deserve a chance to catch a fish. I mean, fishing where I like to fish, there's guys on the bank that are catching salmon that they don't get to go to British Columbia to fish. And it means so much to people, especially, you know, chance to keep a fish and eat it. So my view is I like the portfolio approach. I'm not against all hatcheries. They're part of the landscape, and they're not all going away. It is true that we're overwhelming systems with hatchery fish. So the problem with hatcheries is just too many of them, and the releases are too big. Washington State has really done incalculable damage by their use of fish hatcheries. I mean, there's every single river in Washington State has a hatchery program, and they just keep dumping more hatchery fish into the rivers and wondering why the runs keep tanking. And it's hard to watch. Oregon is not too bad, but I believe it's okay to have some tributaries that are focused on hatchery production and others that are focused on wild fish conservation. And that portfolio, I think, is a viable pathway forward. And so the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife basically did that and zoned the coast. Like the Nehalem is classic. The North Fork of the Nehalem has got a hatchery on it. If you want to kill a hatchery steelhead, that's where you can go. The South Fork, which is much bigger, is wild fish only. The straying is very, very minor. And the South Fork is one of the largest watersheds dedicating to wild fish diversity that's left on the coast south of Canada. So I like the zoning approach. I do see a role for hatcheries. I do think we've got to dial them back in certain places. And we have to mark all the hatchery fish so we know what's hatchery and wild. There's no excuse for not 100% marking your hatchery fish today. Mm-hmm. If you don't mark your hatchery fish, you're just driving blind as a fish manager. You don't know what's wild and what's hatchery. Mm-hmm. So that's a long answer, Jeff.
No, I think it's
question.
Brilliant. The thing that's a challenge is, like, you know, the word wild in Salmon Center or wild fish, anything like that, whether it's Native Fish Society, it is, it creates animosity among anglers who don't understand the role and the role of organizations like the Wild Salmon Center in maintaining those wild stocks. And so in some anglers' minds, they're all the same. A fish is a fish is a fish. And I almost feel like there's an opportunity if hatchery fish are part of the equation and it's part of policy for an organization, it's an opportunity to educate the uninformed that, hey, we're not anti-hatchery. It's just we're not all hatchery. Or, you know.
We need more wild fish rivers. That's for sure.
Right.
But you're right. It's not, I don't subscribe to the, there's, you know, I see a role for hatcheries.
Yeah. And I do too. And I explain that to people who really get angry with me because they associate me with wild fish efforts, wild fish conservation efforts. And I said, look, man, I catch in each hatchery, I eat hatchery fish like, you know, 3 times a week. Mm-hmm. My freezer's full of it. And it's, I wouldn't be the angler that I am if there weren't hatchery fish to take home. So, that's one thing I wanted to clarify is that the misconception and sometimes the just plain animosity towards conservation efforts is apparent. And then as you experienced this spring, sometimes volatile.
Oh, yeah. No, I know. Yeah, it's tough. It's a tough one.
I guess my follow-up to that is, like, if we really did just focus on recovering wild stocks, and they did come back to X, which is carrying capacity for each of those systems, but then you're not allowed to take one home, what happens to the angling public that, you know, the entire culture is based on their opportunity to go fishing?
Yeah, and so obviously you want a constituency that cares about the fish, and there's always catch and release, but, you know, some species like Chinook and fall Chinook, people want a chance to keep a fish. I mean, my view is if the population is managed well and the levels of abundance are there, it's okay to be able to keep a fish or two. You don't need to kill many fall Chinook before you've got enough meat for the whole season because they're huge. So, and the question, I guess the world of fishing is very polarized, right? There's the fly fishermen who are against all hatchery fish, and then there's the gear fishermen who love hatchery fish, and there's the bait fishermen, and there's all these divides, you know. Then you've got commercial. But what's happening is, because it's so balkanized, we're not able to wield the political power that we need to prevail on really important stuff. And this has been an Achilles heel for the fishing community. You know, we should be able to agree on a few things and have the political muscle and strategy to prevail. You know, I mean, marine mammals is a great example. This is a major threat to salmon and steelhead. Mm-hmm. It probably wasn't historically when the abundance levels were high, but they're not high anymore. And you're down to some runs, you know, hundreds of fish. Meanwhile, marine mammal populations have exploded. So it's not a matter of killing all the marine mammals, but it's a matter of active management, which is a really basic principle with the management of any species. And so my point is, when it comes to big threats, the angling community should be able to build more power and work together to achieve those, or whether it's directed on habitat issues or in-stream flow. So I regard that as something that is an area for improvement among all of us who love to fish.
When I spoke with Lantani, you know, he was talking about abundant access and the role of public access on public lands. And I asked him, okay, Lan, so what happens if, you know, you achieve your goal and everyone accesses public lands?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, then I guess we just have to make room for other people. And then the counter to that was, I said, what happens if no one shows up? And I guess that's my question for you, is that as the executive director of this organization, what happens when you solve the problem? In other words, what happens if abundance is achieved on rivers that reach their carrying capacity and the policies are in place to ensure that that's like that it's going to be maintained, sustainable? Mm-hmm. What happens then?
That's a problem that I wish we had more of. And so there's three answers to that. The first is we're setting up a permanent fund by 2032 that'll pay the long-term costs of maintaining these projects that we've started into perpetuity. But most of the time, I mean, we are working in a place because we're trying to get to the goalpost, which is, can we protect this place and can we sustain that level of protection? And there are so many things to compete for what needs to be done in so many rivers that there's never a problem, you know, finding something to focus on. And fundraising, people fund us because we deliver, you know, and our style is not a lot of arm-wavy exaggerations and spin. I mean, we're science-based. We know exactly where we're trying to go. We know exactly what it looks like in 2032. And everything we do is to achieve what we call that durability threshold, where the habitat and the wild fish and the local organizations are all in place to support that. So it's been, there's no shortage of challenges. And fortunately, the people that fund us are really happy with our work. And so, you know, it's, for me, it was pushing a rock uphill for a lot of years. Well, now the rock's rolling along nicely on the level plateau above. The funders are coming to us and they're really enthusiastic.
That's great.
And I'm grateful for that.
That's great. You know, I think that the thing that you and I share is a passion for fly fishing, but also like choosing the most difficult and least productive. And I don't know if it's because we're crazy or what, but it definitely is not easy what we do. And what I guess what I have to say is that I'm very thankful that it is difficult, because as crowded as it is, and it's very crowded, in 2023, it's still possible to carve out a little space to have those moments again, like you and I had that one evening where the fish were coming in on an incoming tide. It was one of the nicest evenings where we both found fish. And I think, so for me, that's kind of my North Star, in that when people, and if people, connect with the resource, and on whatever resource it is, but connect with it in that way, in its truest natural form, where in our case, the fish have just come out of the ocean. They've literally are coming into the river to do what they do, and you intercept them with a little piece of, you know, hair on a hook, and have that one-on-one encounter. If more people had that, I think that we would be in a different place. But the conundrum is that if everyone had that, then we wouldn't have the ability to carve out that little space. So I think, you know, moving forward, I'm just thankful that we have that, but making sure that the population has an opportunity to experience that is just as important as me continuing to have that experience.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, what gets me on the river is fishing challenges and pursuing exciting fish and solving the puzzle, you know, tying different patterns, experimenting, different retrieves, different positioning. A lot of it is learning from the other people on the river. It's interesting, I spent a lot of time anchored next to a guy on a bridge the spring who fishes quickfish, and I learned so much about how to fish that river just sitting next to him. He's, you know, a gear fisherman, but he was a good fisherman. So the power and the satisfaction that comes from getting in the heads of a species and its ecosystem and figuring it out, trial and error and the occasional connection, that is really exciting. But as we figure it out, I don't want anyone else anchored where I'm fishing.
I know.
I don't tell anyone where I fish. I don't tell my best friends where I fish anymore. I've just learned the hard way. Otherwise, you're going to come show up there the next day and someone's going to be anchored in your spot with your own technique. And so I've just taken me years to just keep my mouth shut. Mm-hmm. I mean, for me, one of the most exciting experiences, though, was learning how to fish the Taiman rivers of the Russian Far East. And being, you know, me and Misha Skopets and Ilya Sherbovich were the first fly fishermen on, like, the Tugur, you know, which is a big system in the Russian Far East that has giant taimen. And these taimen feed on adult salmon, so they get to be over 100 pounds. And nobody had really figured them out on a fly, the big ones. And we spent a lot of years not catching anything and trying different patterns and it not working. And slowly we started to figure it out. That experience is incredibly fulfilling and exciting. And the same thing with, you know, with salmon and steelhead, we think we have all the answers. It's not dialed in. There's a lot we don't know. And we're always developing new techniques. So I love that process, you know. It's a creative process, but also it's tuning up your aptitude for understanding what's happening in nature. And that reaches down to some very basic human behaviors that are also very satisfying. So I'm just grateful, you know, that I have to have rivers that have mystery and spectacular fish and chances to figure things out, you know, and learn from good fishermen. And yeah, we steal a few things from each other when they're not looking at their technique and this technique. And it's kind of a good-natured, not really a competition, but as you know, and especially when you're fishing on the Oregon coast, a lot of the rivers we fish are really crowded. There's boats anchored all over the place. And I'm kind of getting used to that because there's a lot of fish there too. But what's also fascinating is to see how the other fishermen are doing and how their techniques are working or not working. And we've all been anchored in a pool or wading through a run when the guy upstream or downstream is hooking up and we're not. And it's those moments where it's like you just have to teach yourself, just stop. And then a new kind of learning threshold comes around the corner.
Wait, stop and take a breath.
Stop and take a breath. And then I take my rod and smash it over my freaking knee. And then I take the blunt end and harpoon myself with self-flagellation.
There have been days where I'm downstream of you. I look up and, oh, God, Guido's got another one on. It's like, God, what am I doing
wrong? Oh, come on, Jeff. Now he's blown smoke. Now I once in a while connect. And then, but anyway, Jeff, I mean, your question's a really good question. And I think it's a gift to be able to know great water, to learn it and come back again, to have a chance at mysterious and powerful fish and delve into the mystery. And it's a gift to be able to fight to save those rivers. And that's kind of the holy grail. And I will add, it's also beautiful to write about the rivers too, but just don't tell too much about the information and techniques.
I like why to, and that why we fish, and I talk a little bit about how to, but I don't ever say where to.
No, you really, this is a double-edged sword and a slippery slope.
Totally.
When you're talking about public water and your own home water, less is better.
Right.
You know.
And it's a challenge, because if everyone knows about it, then you have more bullets in your magazine for advocacy, but if no one goes...
Yeah,
you don't have any bullets, but at the same time, the fishing's better. So it's kind of this.
I'm struggling with it. But what keeps me going are those days on the water. And then if I see something bad happen to that river, you know, it really pisses me off. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, and so just the determination to not let anybody damage your home water is a fundamental obligation of every fisherman.
I agree.
It comes with the territory. And that's our job as fishermen. I mean, Nate, we are given the gift to spend time in these gorgeous, beautiful places, but that gift comes with the obligation to protect it, and it also fires up our engines too.
Mm-hmm. That's a very nice way to wrap it up. I mean, there's so many things we can talk about. We could talk about the health of the ocean. We can talk about, you know, competing species in a particular latitudinal line on the Pacific Ocean and how there's not enough food for them. I mean, we could spin this thing totally out, but focusing on the terrestrial landscape, focusing on the forest and the clean water is really where I think we can make a difference.
Well, the problem with the ocean is, for the most part, we can't control it. So we know the ocean's having a major impact, especially on steelhead. There are some things we can control in the ocean, and that is the release of hatchery pink salmon, which Southeast Alaska is just flooding the ocean. And there's a lot of wild pink salmon too, but the ocean is awash in pink salmon, and they compete with the other salmon species for food. And we know this because there's alternating big years and slow years for pinks on a two-year cycle. But all those hatchery fish on top of natural high abundance has put the ocean in a tipping point. And this is really serious. The second thing in the ocean we can control is the interception of fish by distant fleets. So Alaska catches 60% of Snake River salmon disappear in Alaska's commercial fishery and northern British Columbia. The queets, 60% of those fish are gone. So this is a real issue. But those are two things, and those are two things we can control. You know, it'll take some work. Now, saving the rivers, if you don't save the rivers and the genetic diversity of wild fish, nothing else can happen. So you can't even, once you lose a river and it's locally adapted wild fish, generally it's not coming back, you know. And lose, I put in quotation marks. I mean, so there's been some great recovery stories from low population size. I mean, there's some fascinating stories. Butte Creek in the Sacramento, now has one of the biggest, this is a creek that flows into the Sacramento, has one of the biggest spring Chinook runs in the Pacific Northwest because of the genetic diversity. They learned how to utilize the available habitat seasonally, and the population exploded. But we've got to protect the habitat of our home rivers, the in-stream flow, and the integrity of the wild runs. And if we can do that, we can keep our fish.
My 30,000-foot view on this is, here's a man who dedicated his life to something that he truly believes in and feels like he can make a difference. In other words, you would probably not have pursued this without a vision of how to achieve your goal. Is that right?
Oh, no. I knew very tangibly what it looked like. And I wasn't going to try to do everything, but I was just going to try to do this, which is the stronghold strategy.
Yeah. I've always been impressed with your ability to make this thing a cohesive effort, but also be effective on the ground.
You know, I appreciate that. We're never, ever, ever, ever going to give up. And we're going to set up a funding operation so that all the work will be funded in perpetuity. I've benefited from being trained by some of the best conservation professionals in the business. You know, Peter Seligman, Spencer Beebe. And they were all graduates of, they all went to the Yale Forestry School, which is interesting where I went. But they're also veterans of the Nature Conservancy. And a practitioner in this kind of conservation needs to learn how to fundraise. So major donor fundraising is central. How to build credibility, communicate, take people to the rivers, build a long-term relationship, and secure the funding you need to implement your work. And that is a very fundamental piece of the toolbox of a conservation practitioner, because if you can't get the money to work at scale, you simply can't be as effective as you'd need to be. So I'm blessed to have been trained by some of the best. And the relationships that we've built over the years are still with us, you know? And I'm a believer in going to the river. And I've told my whole team, you need to get out on the water. You know, that's how you fire your engines. And it's pretty fundamental. It's not just, well, let's go fishing. It's like, no, we need to go talk to the river.
You know? So true. Well, thank you. This has been a great conversation. You and I have had many conversations, but it's never been around microphones. We've never been. They usually have involved, most recently, tequila on the rocks, which is a really nice way to celebrate the evening.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's an early morning coffee-infused conversation that I really enjoyed. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
The last great places for salmon and steelhead can always use your help. So go to wildsalmoncenter.org and check out what they're up to. Their list of accomplishments around the Pacific Rim is pretty impressive. This episode of Fin and Fire with Jeff Mishler is brought to you by Fin and Fire, a fly shop unlike any other. It is the West's leading retailer of your favorite outdoor brands, and their helpful staff is known for getting you on the water with the right gear. Go to finandfire.com, check out their inventory, and see what I'm talking about.